Thanks, Jack. Thank you. It is great to be back with you. Let me also recognize a special guest that we have tonight, our Congressman, Congressman Gary Miller. Congressman, where are you? Where's Congressman? Come on, bro. I have a special presentation by Congressman Miller. Go ahead, brother.
Where's Pastor Jack? Come on back up here. You've been sitting too long. Hey, I love this guy. How about you?
You're kind. You're kind.
Well, the first thing I'd like to present is to you, the church. It's a certificate of congressional recognition to Calvary Chapel, Chino Hills, in honor of the congregation's dedicated service, civic engagement, patriotic spirit within the community. May the coming year be filled with faith, growth, and much success. God bless.
Oh, thank you so much. Awesome. Thank you. Amazing.
No, no, you're not true. I'm going to ask you, I've got a question. Is it okay if I give your pastor a personal gift from me? Is that all right?
Oh, my.
I'm a real history buff, and I know you're a history buff, too, and I love this guy. I mean, I've listened to what he says, and he's not shy, is he? And I love the way he loves this country. He knows what this country has been, what it can be. He knows things that are going wrong that need to be corrected. And I really am a history buff, and I think every day we go through life is part of history. And on 9/11, we were attacked. There were no flags flown over our nation's capital because we were attacked prior to the time they go to fly the flags. And on 9/11, the first anniversary, I put a request in early to have flags flown. They flew mine first, and then they realized other members started requesting them, so they limited how many everybody else could get except me. I already had mine. And so I'm going to give him something that's it is really, really rare. In fact, I gave one of these away about 4 years ago to a nonprofit that were raising money for a charity. I thought it was really good, and it sold for over $10,000. And it's a flag that was flown on the first anniversary of 9/11 over our nation's capital. And I'd like to have you as a personal gift.
Oh, man. Thank you so much.
And there's a certificate inside. A certificate.
Thank you so much.
I love you. You're doing a great job. And this is where it's at.
I appreciate it so much. Thank you so much. God bless you.
Thank you.
Wow.
Woo! Wow. Thank you.
Thank you, Congressman. Let me begin tonight. You see the titles up on both sides here, Have We Forgotten? And I want to take us back, and I'm going to use a lot of slides tonight, and I'm going to try to move very quickly through them and just give you some visualization, some things that have gone on in history. But in looking at what has happened with 9/11, this is another day in infamy. You remember that 68 years ago, President Franklin Roosevelt called what happened in Pearl Harbor a day that will live in infamy. You don't want many of those days on your national calendar. We've had a few, and 9/11 was another one of those days that will live in infamy. It was 8 years ago that we saw what happened at the Trade Center. We saw what happened at the Pentagon. We saw what happened at the field in Pennsylvania. This picture on the right is a picture that was taken by Officer Mike Garcia just moments after the Pentagon was hit, when it was still aflame, before it collapsed. There is actually one of my friends is in that thing burning right there. I'll talk to you about him in a little bit. I was in D.C. at the time. I heard the plane hit. We rushed outside. It shook the ground. We wondered what was happening. We saw the smoke. We saw what was going on. And so what has happened is in that period of time, that short period of just a few hours, we saw a remarkable number of casualties, several thousand, over 3,000 casualties, and about 2,300 that were wounded at that point in time. First responders were right there among those that were killed and wounded. They were the first ones in trying to rescue those folks. And as we saw what happened as a result of 9/11, we drew a line in the sand and said, we're not putting up with this anymore. And that led to the beginning of what we now call the War on Terror. That War on Terror has gone for 8 years. It's, I don't think, anywhere close to over. I was talking to some military folks yesterday, Medal of Honor winner, talking to some generals. They think it's probably a 20-year war. And I think that that's at least probably what we're looking at with this thing. And what's happened is we have seen the area where this has occurred. And as you look across there, a lot of the salmon color that you see there is the old Ottoman Empire, the old Islamic Empire that prevailed back in World War I. As you look across that region, that's where so much of the conflict is happening right now in the war on terror. And we see the images that have come out of that area. We see all the pictures. We get a regular diet of what happens in the war on terror with all the reporting that goes there. And the pictures that we see create a public perception. We have a perception of what is going on in the war on terror. Now, the perception of what is going on, of all the pictures of there, I think the one that we have seen most often over the last 8 years has been the ones of the soldiers who are being brought back, the caskets, the funerals, the Arlington Cemetery. And when I checked with the Pentagon yesterday, we were about 4,060 lives now lost in the war on terror, military lives that have been lost in the war on terror. And so as we see this, it develops a public perception. This is one of the things that has made this a very unpopular war. We consider 4,000 lost lives, it's a waste. We shouldn't have been in this. And you know the criticism that goes with the war. Now, what's happened is there's a public perception, but then there's another side that I happen to be exposed to on a number of occasions, and you too. It's because I have so many good friends who have served so many tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. Jerry Walton is one. He's the oldest special forces person in the Army. I mean, he is 56 and has been through a number of wars. He is a photographer of the Pentagon. The pictures he brings back and the stories he brings, I've heard none of them on the news, not a single one. He has a perspective that's totally opposite to what's out there. Kane Schuler, my son-in-law, just finished his third tour over in Iraq. The stories I get from him, nothing. I've heard none of that on the news whatsoever. And so as I hear the soldiers, and as I've talked to so many of them, they come back on their two-week R&R. I haven't found a soldier yet who comes back on a two-week R&R that can last more than a week before he cuts off the news. He's just tired of listening to the news because he's there and sees it, and what he hears here is not the same thing. But we don't get the perspective oftentimes of that. We get a public perception that is created by the news. And that public perception, it's there. But I want to remind you of a Bible verse that's out there. And the Bible verse that I think is very significant. It's the basis of part of the due process rights we have, particularly in the Fifth Amendment. But the Bible verse, Proverbs 18:17, says this. It says, "He who states his case first seems right until someone tells the other side and sets the record straight." See, that's why you get to confront your accuser in court. Your accuser side sounds really good until you get to call the witnesses on the other side and tell the rest of the story. And that's the way it's been with the war on terror. And even as we look on the war on terror, and it's had a public perception, it's been very unpopular, and, you know, et cetera, all the stuff that goes with it. I think the other element that we miss is that this is not just a war. There is a spiritual dimension to this, and there's a historical dimension to this. And I think we oftentimes, as Americans, really don't recognize both of those dimensions. And I want to share some of that with you tonight. I want to talk to you a little bit about a spiritual and a historical perspective of the war on terror, because as you go back into that region of the world, this is not a new thing for America. We think it is. It's not a new thing. I love a statement that President Woodrow Wilson made. President Wilson said this. He said, "A nation which does not remember what it was yesterday does not know what it is today nor what it's trying to do." He said, we're trying to do a futile thing if we don't know where we've come from or what we've been about. Now, that literally is the case, because when you look at this portion of the world where so much conflict is going right now, and by the way, we get a steady diet of seeing all the anti-Americanism that comes out of that part of the world, all the folks that are angry at America. And let me go back to that map for just a minute. You see that Islamic area of the world. What is the predominant language throughout the Islamic empire? Arabic, sure. Ever noticed how all the signs are in English? Most of the folks in that region of the world do not speak English at all, but they're smart enough to know how to use our media against us better than we are in discerning that our media is being used against us. They're happy to do all these things with American signs so that our media will be happy to feed it back home so that we see how angry everybody is with America and how terrible we are. I mean, we don't even recognize sometimes when we're being used, but that's a great example. These guys do not speak English, and yet all the protest signs happen to be written in English. So as you look at that portion of the world, this is not a new portion of the world. We're involved in the war on terror right now. You'll find that we've already had a war over there. America had a 32-year-long conflict over there. That 32-year-long conflict was Americans against Muslim terrorists. It was called the Barbary Power War. It's not even in textbooks anymore, but it started in 1784. As soon as we finished the American Revolution, it lasted under four different presidents. I want to tell you something about that tonight, because as I show you the diplomatic correspondence from 200 years ago, you're going to say, that sounds just like the State Department. I think I heard that on the news yesterday. It's very common. common to what we see now, except we've already been through it before. Now, as you look back to that point in time, as Americans, we were all over the world 200 years before America even was founded as a nation. And we're talking 600 years ago, international law had been settled. International law tells you that you get so much water off your coast, and that's your territorial waters, and past that is the international waters, and you can't mess with people in international waters. It's all settled, been settled for hundreds of years before the American Revolution. And so that's why commercial ships do not carry cannons with them as they were sailing. Now, they'd carry a couple of cannons. They'd use one that they'd often shoot booms off if they were in fog to let other ships know they were around, kind of like a foghorn. They'd have a couple of harpoon cannons maybe, but they didn't carry cannons. Well, because of that, what happened was, as we would sail over into the part of the world throughout Europe and up into Russia, where we were allies with Russia at that point in time, as we would sail into that region, what happened was there were five Islamic nations that every time they saw an American flag, they went after our ships, they went after our people. No way of defending ourselves. We're in commercial waters. We're commercial ships. We don't have defense. And so what they would do is they would take and attack and slaughter Americans all across the world. Everywhere they found an American flag, they'd go after the Americans. Now, in going after the Americans, slaughtering the Americans, they soon decided, wait a minute, this is not the best way to do this. Instead of killing the Americans, if we'll just take them and make them slaves and make them prisoners, we can sell them back to the American government for ransom, and we can get more money to finance our operations. So what happened was they would take the ships, they would kill who they needed to, but they would enslave the rest, and they had a set price to sell these guys back to America. If you were a ship's captain, you were worth $6,000, about $6,500 a day. Officers, sailors, it took about $1 million to be able to ransom one of the ships back. So all these commercial ships were sending out all over the world. They're getting whacked. They're being captured. To buy the crews back, it takes us about $1 million. And so in looking to do that, this is where Congress said, we've got to do something with this problem. We have a problem with this Islamic terrorist. Five nations particularly were sponsoring the attacks. And we said, we've got to do something. Now, at this point, we're 1 year after the American Revolution. 1783 is when we signed the peace treaty to end the war with Great Britain. We're now in our first year as a fully independently recognized nation. We don't have much in the way of diplomacy. We haven't done anything internationally to speak of. And so what Congress decides to do is let's go do some negotiations with these five nations, see if we can't get some things to the table where that we can stop these attacks. So Congress dispatched the first diplomats to go negotiate with the Muslim terrorists. Those first diplomats were, on the left there, Ben Franklin, then John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. They were the first three that were sent overseas to negotiate with the leaders from those five separate nations. And these guys traveled among the nations trying to see what they could to settle down the conflicts and how do you keep Americans from getting attacked. And as they would go in different nations, it ended up that John Adams and Thomas Jefferson worked a lot together in the same nations. And after about 2 years, they had developed a close enough relationship with one of the Islamic ambassadors that they asked him. They said, you know, we've been talking, negotiating 2 years here. We just need you to explain some things to us that we don't understand. We don't understand why the unprovoked attacks. We've never done anything to you guys. We've never conflicted with you in any way, shape, fashion, or form. And you keep attacking us all over the world, and we've done nothing. Explain why. And the ambassador looked at him and said, it's very simple. And this is in State Department papers. They're actually online nowadays, and you can read them online. And this is what the ambassador told Adams and Jefferson that they reported back to the Continental Congress, to the Foreign Affairs Department, the Continental Congress. This is what he said. He said, this is Adams and Jefferson writing. He said, the ambassador answered our question. He answered us, and he said that it was founded on the laws of their prophet Muhammad, that it was written in their Quran that all nations who should not have acknowledged their authority were sinners. If you don't admit that Islam is great over your nation and that you're an Islamic nation, then he said, it's our right and our duty to make war upon you wherever you can be found, which is why they were attacking American ships anywhere they could find it, and to make slaves of all and take as prisoners, and that every Muslim who should be slain in battle was sure to go to paradise. He said, it's real simple. It's not that you guys did anything to us. This is what we're taught to do. This is what we're supposed to do. If you do not submit and acknowledge that Muslim is superior, we're supposed to make war against you. We're supposed to fight you. We're supposed to make you prisoners. It's our duty to make war, as a matter of fact. And by the way, in doing that, if we get killed, it's good for us because we go to paradise. So this is why it's not what you guys did. It's not what did it. This is what we've been taught to do because this is in our holy book. Now, this is what was told the State Department back then. This was new thinking for Americans. We're not used to thinking like this. We're not used to thinking that if you kill somebody, you go to heaven. It usually is exactly the opposite. So this is a little bit of adjustment of thinking that's having to go on here because we've been trying to negotiate. And see, this is the problem we often have. In the Western world, we think everybody thinks like the Western world, and that's not true. And that's what we found out 200 years ago. We weren't thinking on the same plane. So what happened was we started dispatching other negotiators. We had five nations. Only three ambassadors were working. We sent General William Eaton out. And General William Eaton was another one that was working among the five nations and trying to reach some agreements. And he sent back some analysis to the State Department. Again, it was the Department of Foreign Affairs at that point in time. And his reports are very interesting. I thought this was intriguing. He said, the Muslims believe that the Americans are a feeble sect of Christians. Now, at that time, the Muslims had declared war on nine Christian nations. They'd gone after America. They'd gone after Sweden. They'd gone after Norway. They'd gone after France. They'd gone after England. They'd gone after Spain and Portugal. They had nine nations they declared war on. America was one of the nine. They were all nine Christian nations. They said, the Americans, they are a feeble sect of Christians. Now, why would they think that the Americans were a feeble sect of Christians? The answer was, he said, it's a maxim of the Muslim states that the Christians who would be on good terms with them must fight well or pay well. Our problem was we couldn't fight well. We didn't have a navy. We had to get France to come be our navy in the American Revolution. So we've got Americans being attacked all over the world, and we can't do anything to defend them. We have not raised a single weapon against a Muslim anywhere in the world because we can't defend ourselves. So we're now put in the position of having to pay well. Now, what did that mean? And by the way, this is what George Washington inherited. This was the problem he had with Muslim terrorists when he became president. You see, he's president now, and so the axiom is that you have to fight well or you have to pay well. That's the only options you've got. Now, when you take that as an option, how well did we fight? Well, we just showed we can beat the British anywhere. That's no problem. But the problem we have is we didn't believe in having a standing army. At that time, we said, look, if anybody attacks us, we'll be happy to go home and get the squirrel gun off the mantelpiece again and come back and shoot you. It's not going to be a problem. But now we're talking about defending Americans in other parts of the world. And we'd never thought about that before. We didn't want a standing military. It's what Great Britain had. Founders were against that. But now we're saying, well, then how do we protect Americans across the world if we don't have a military? Now, if you can't fight well, the other option is that you have to pay well. And so what they did, these five nations would say, well, we think maybe we can stop some of the attacks if you can perhaps give us about $1 million a year, and if you can also build us four or five frigates a year out of your shipyard there in Boston. And they would go through a real litany, and they said, if we can get all these things, we think we can get some of those attacks cut down and maybe save some of your citizens. And so they called it tribute. We would have to pay tribute. And it's nothing but extortion and blackmail. That's the only option we had because we could not fight well, so we had to pay well. It's interesting that by the time we got to 1795 in George Washington's administration, 1795, 16% of the federal budget was being spent on Muslim terrorism. 16% is what we were paying to try to keep terrorists from attacking American citizens. Now, you can imagine for an old war horse general like he was, he didn't like this. He didn't like being pushed into a corner and blackmailed, and he was very outspoken about it. Matter of fact, this is what he said. He said, would to heaven that we had a navy able to reform those enemies to mankind or to crush them into non-existence. Man, if I had a military, I could go over there and take, he said, I just wish I had a navy I could take and do something. And his philosophy was very simple. He said, to be prepared for war is one of the most effectual means of preserving peace. He said, we weren't prepared for this war, so we're having to pay our way out of it. It was in 1795 that he gave an address to Congress that was the first time in American history that we had a call for a standing army. He asked Congress, he said, can we build a navy? We now see the need for a navy because with a navy, we can put our Marines on the ships. We can go to other parts of the world and defend our citizens in any part of the world. We need a navy. And that's the first call we had for a standing army. George Washington got to see the beginning of the navy. He got to see as they were doing it. But it took a while to build that navy. And so his vice president, John Adams, is the one who got to oversee the construction of the navy. And that's why John Adams is called the father of the American Navy, because it was finally under him that they got the navy. All right, now, Adams is ready. He's got a navy. He's got the Marines. Let's go get these Americans back. Didn't happen. Why wouldn't it happen? Because at this point, John Adams has actually been dealing with these terrorists for about 14 years. He was the first ambassador to dispatched. He was vice president of George Washington, had to deal with this. Now he's president. And his explanation is very simple. He said, I can't send the Navy to do this. He said, if we get involved in a war, he said, it's going to be a long war against Muslim terrorism. And he said, I don't think the American people have the stomach for a long war, so I'm not going to do it. And I thought, that's an interesting comment. That's kind of what we hear a lot today, the discontent, time to come home, time to get out of there. No, a war against this kind of thinking takes a while, and he understood that. He had been negotiating for 13, 14 years, and so he didn't do it. Well, the next president of the United States was Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson now has dealt with this longer than Adams has, because not only was he first ambassador, he was Secretary of State under President George Washington. He was vice president under John Adams. Now he's president on his own right, and when he got it in 1801, 20% of the federal budget was being spent on Islamic terrorism. So at that point in time, he said, that's it. No more. It stops right here. And so he made an announcement. His public policy speech is very simple. He said, I was very unwilling that we should acquiesce in the humiliation of paying a, quote, tribute. I very early thought it would be best to effect a peace through the medium of war. He said, I sent word to all the nations that we're not paying you a cent anymore. If you want to see us, we'll be happy to bring our Navy over and show it to you, but we're not sending you any money. And so it was real simple. It was at that point that among these five nations, nations like Tripoli and others started declaring official war on the United States. The first officially declared war against the United States after the American Revolution was by Muslim terrorists who said, if you're not going to pay us, we're having an official war. Well, we've been at war anyway, which is we didn't have a way to fight back. So at this point, you have Jefferson, who takes the new built Navy, and he gives two military expeditions. He loads the Marines up, and under Commodore Edward Preble and under General William Eaton, he sent these two expeditions over there. He said, you go show them that we're not going to put up with this anymore. So they land, and by the way, if you've seen the Marine Corps flag or the Marine Corps hymn, what's the Marine Corps hymn? From the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli? That was one of the five Islamic terrorist nations that we were dealing with at the time. When we sing the Marine Corps hymn, we didn't understand that we were talking about the first war on terror that happened way back at the beginning, but that's exactly what happened. Shores of Tripoli, that's one of the places where that they took the expeditions in, and it was General William Eaton who had the overall command of that entire expedition. He wrote journals on it. They're really cool journals. These are some of the journals that we own. And in those journals, he talks very explicitly. You see here, General William Eaton, you see what it says here? He says, he was commander of the Christian and other forces, and where were they? They were in Tripoli. You see Tripoli right there. Now, at this point in time, I want to stop for just a second, because Tripoli becomes a significant debate today. Not in the sense that we're talking about the war on terror, but what happens is there's what's called the Treaty of Tripoli. If you ever hear anybody say, oh, America's got a Christian heritage, you're going to find a letter to the editor or an op-ed piece or an editorial piece that says how stupid it is to think that America's a Christian nation. Why, don't you know the Treaty of Tripoli? Article 11 of the Treaty of Tripoli. And it's very similar to what the president said recently. President Obama, when he made the trip overseas to Turkey, he made an announcement in Turkey. He said, we don't consider ourselves a Christian nation. We're not a Christian nation. And when he said that, you had the New York Times that immediately went up and said, he's right. Article 11 of the Treaty of Tripoli. Article 11 of the Treaty of Tripoli, interesting treaty, 1797. This is what Article 11 starts with. It says, the government of the United States is in no sense founded on the Christian religion. Now, you read that and you go, well, maybe they're right. The government of the United States is in no sense founded on the Christian religion? Wow, if I saw that, I would think, you know, they're right. America doesn't have a Christian nation heritage. It can't be, because we're in no sense founded on the Christian. The problem is these knotheads put a period in the middle of a sentence where there is no period. If you check the punctuation, read the rest of the sentence, it says, the government of the United States is in no sense founded on the Christian religion as having in itself no character of enmity or hostility against the laws, religion, or tranquility of Muslims. What they said, and we negotiated nearly a dozen treaties like this, they said, look, you guys are Muslims, we're Christians, and we don't hate you because you're Muslims. Now, we hate terrorists, but we don't hate you because of your religion. We don't have any character of hatred against it. Now, why was that important? Because the Muslims were attacking these nations in retaliation for what all the Christian nations had done to them back in the Dark Ages. And if you remember that period of time, that's when the church said, oh, we got to advance God's kingdom by force. There were a couple of teachings that were going around back in the about through 800, 900, up through about 1400, 1500. And they were real simple. And you recall that in the history of the world, illiteracy was exceptionally high. It's what was called the Dark Ages back then. People could not read. Very few elites could read, either in church or state. And so what happened was church and state leaders to all these people who couldn't read said, you guys love God and you want to do what's right for God, right? Now we all know, everybody knows that Jesus was crucified by the Jews. So if you want to please God, you go find yourself a Jew and kill a Jew and Jesus will be really happy with you. And so that was one of the things that happened was they started killing Jews. To this day, Jews still have real difficulty with Christians because of what happened 700 years ago with these Christian leaders of church and state who were saying, go kill a Jew because they killed Jesus. It's not Jesus' teaching, but we couldn't read back then. The Bible wasn't even a language we could understand, so we just did what we were told. Same thing, and while you're at it, if you can find yourself a Muslim and kill a Muslim, Jesus will be really happy with you then. And see, that's where you have all the things that happened in the torture, they created the star chain. See, it all happened in the name of Christianity, but that's where they created the star chambers. And if you were a Muslim, then you're going to get killed by the Christians because of that. And if you don't renounce your faith and accept Christianity by coercion, you're going to get yourself killed. And we've got other ways to help you decide that you do want to convert to Christianity. So we would use fire and torture to help people convert. You know, we can get them to be Christians. And we'd burn the stake. We even burned our own people at stake. I mean, the people who translated the Bible into the common language. Wycliffe and Huss and Tyndale, they got burned at the stake. So this is the way Christianity was for several hundred years, no question about it. But that's not what we brought to America. What we brought to America was a Bible-based Christianity. Said, we don't believe in coercion. We're not going to put you to death for what you believe. We have rights of conscience. You can be any denomination you want to be. You can be no denomination. We had all this stuff going. It was real different from what Europe was. And that's the Founding Fathers were really proud of that. As a matter of fact, if you look at quotes, the Founding Fathers talked about how we did not do that. You take somebody like Daniel Webster, the great defender of the Constitution, as one of his great joys. He says, in American Christianity, the sword and the burning stake are unknown. General tolerant Christianity is the law of the land. We don't put people to death for not being Christians. We don't burn you at the stake until you confess Christ. We don't do that. Other founding fathers who were very outspoken about their Christian faith did the same thing. If you look at folks like John Jay, now John Jay is the original Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. He's the founder of the American Bible Society. He's the president of the American Bible Society, a great theologian. He says Christianity in America is enlightened Christianity. We don't do that European stuff that was done over there. And see, that's one of the things that the Muslims remembered was the expulsion of the Muslims from Spain and Portugal and how they were treated. They said, we're going to get back at you Christians for what you're doing. Not in America. We didn't believe that. John Adams, same way. John Adams, very outspoken. He said the Christianity we have in America is irrational. Somebody's actually thinking. We're not just burning people because they don't believe right. John Quincy Adams, who is another one of the leaders of the American Bible Society, he actually did a book for 10-year-old Americans showing them how to read the Bible from cover to cover once a year. He said the Christianity we have in America is civilized. It's not like that European stuff. So what happens when we talk about the Treaty of Tripoli, we're saying, hey, guys, we're not the historical Christianity you dealt with 700 years ago. We don't have any hatred against the laws or tradition or the religion of Muslims. That's not going on in America. We're a Christian nation, but we're not the Christian nation you're used to. See, that's all the treaty said. It didn't say we're not a Christian nation. It says we're not a government. Our government is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion that has a hatred of Muslims. That's not our Christianity. So that's what the treaty is. Next time you see that in the newspaper and they say, oh, the Treaty of Tripoli, you know, Christians, you're all wrong. Just have them read the entire Article 11 instead of the first 18 words. All they do is read the first few words, and they put a period where there is no period. Have them read the 88 words in the paragraph, and it makes a whole different statement. And by the way, notice that General William Eaton said that in this Treaty of Tripoli controversy, he says, I was the leader of the Christian forces. That kind of says that maybe it was a Christian nation fighting a Muslim nation, right? I mean, he's the leader of the Christian forces that were sent from America over there. So this is the Treaty of Tripoli. So he's leading this expedition, going through these five nations, trying to take care of the terrorism that's there. And he started out still trying. He's the general, but remember, he was over there negotiating for years. So he's still trying to be the negotiator. And if you read his diary across the weeks, you see how he changes. He starts off being the negotiator. For example, April 8th, he said, we find it almost impossible to inspire these wild bigots with confidence us or to persuade them that being Christians, we can be otherwise than enemies to Muslims. We have a difficult undertaking. They keep thinking that just because we're Christians that we have to be enemies. He said, we keep telling them, no, we don't have to be enemies just because we're Christians. He said, this is a difficult undertaking. They're so bigoted against Christians that they think Christians have got to be their enemies. Well, 6 weeks later, he's had a change of opinion. He's tired of negotiating. 6 weeks later, he says, the commander-in-chief of the enemy's forces has offered for my head $6,000 and double the sum for me, a prisoner, and $30 per head for Christians. Why don't he come and take it? I love that military attitude. You want a piece of me? Come on. Yeah. I mean, that, real simple. That's what I'm tired of negotiating. They want me. They can come get me. Well, they came, and they didn't like what they found when they got there because the American Marines were waiting, and the American Marines went right through. But it was a five-year conflict. It was not a short period of time. For 5 years, we were on the ground fighting door to door and house to house and country to country, the same kind of stuff we've got now. Was not an easy period of time. So Jefferson had that. And Jefferson, you see, at that point in time, by the time that little skirmish ended, he's been 21 years in dealing with Islam at that point in time. And so Jefferson, you may remember back in January of 2005, Keith Ellison from the 5th Congressional District of Minnesota was sworn into Congress on the Quran. He refused to take the oath on the Bible. He said, I'm going to take it on the Quran. He was reported to be the first Muslim member of Congress. And what's significant, you see the Quran he's got there? That's Thomas Jefferson's Quran. Thomas Jefferson had a Quran? Why would Thomas Jefferson have a Quran? You remember back when that ambassador said, we do this because the Quran requires it. We're supposed to fight you. That's our duty. And if we get killed, we go to heaven. Jefferson said, you got to be kidding me. He went out and got a Quran to read it for himself because he couldn't believe anybody actually believed that. So he got the Quran. He learned how Muslims thought, how the Islamic nations thought, and that's what he used to conduct war against those five nations was, okay, I know how they think. I know how my enemy thinks. See, this was nothing more than what Sun Tzu had said thousands of years earlier in the principles of war is know your enemy. He said, okay, I got a Quran. I know how they think. I know how we can fight this thing. What's interesting is when Keith Ellison was sworn in, he made the comment, he said, the fact that this is Thomas Jefferson's Quran shows the positive influence of Islam on Thomas Jefferson. No, not quite. It was just the opposite. Now, you know, it distressed a lot of people that we had a Muslim sworn into Congress at a time of the global war on terror. And it's interesting that while the media said he's the first Muslim sworn in Congress, I'm not sure that's the case, because if you go back to founding father John Randolph of Roanoke, and by the way, he served under all the early presidents. I mean, he's elected to Congress early on. He's elected when we're having the war on terror back then. And so he's elected and served through all the early presidents. He said, I hated Christianity and I loved Islam. He made it real clear. He said he held a position in favor of Mohammedism and rejoiced in all of his triumphs over the cross of Christianity. He held a position of natural repugnance to Christianity. So here we have a professing Islamic person, Muslim, serving in the House of Representatives. What do we do with that? Real simple. Francis Scott Key knew exactly what to do. He converted him and led him to Christ. It's a real simple way to take care of the thing. So, Francis Scott Key, you know, did the Star Spangled Banner, but he was an outspoken Christian. He was a strong evangelist, and he led John Randolph of Roanoke to Jesus Christ. He became a firm and committed Christian, and that's the simplest way to handle the concerns that people may have about who's serving in Congress. So, it's just, you know, get another Francis Scott Key. So going back to Jefferson, he's dealt with this for a number of years. He's had the troops on the ground, and we get a relative time of peace. Now, the next president is James Madison. James Madison, the notable feature of his administration was the War of 1812. Now, the War of 1812, when it's going, what happened was those five Islamic nations said, you know what? They can't do anything to us now. Their army and navy is all tied up fighting the British. So they went back after Americans across the world again. Did the same thing they'd been doing before. And they figured there's nothing we can do. But as soon as the war was ended in 1815, at that point in time, Madison dispatched another military expedition overseas. Actually, two more expeditions. He launched with Colonel William Bainbridge, and he also launched with Stephen Decatur, who had been in the first expedition under Jefferson. They went back, and for the next 2 years, they did exactly what they had done under Jefferson. And so by 1816, we had brought the terrorists to the table for the second time, and this time they said, okay, we've had it. You've been here twice. We get the message. We don't want to have to face you again. And that's the first time we had peace for a little bit of time. Now, it was 32 years of conflict that we had in that period of time. You look at what happened, 32 years of conflict against Islamic terrorism back in the beginning of the nation. You look at the four different military expeditions that have gone there, and you say, no, wait a minute, why was it that they were wanting to fight Americans? And just keep this thought in mind. Well, why fight Americans? Well, let's go back there for a minute. You remember what the ambassador told Adams and Jefferson's in the State Department papers? He said very simply, the ambassador answers, it was founded on the laws of their prophet Muhammad. It was written in their Quran that all nations who should not have acknowledged their authority were sinners, that it was their right and their duty to make war upon them wherever they could be found, and that every Muslim who should be slain in battle was sure to go to paradise. That's also, that mentality is also affirmed in many other State Department writings. Timothy Pickering was Secretary of State under George Washington and under John Adams, and he has the same writings. He says, taught by revelation, now Muslims, taught by revelation, taught by the Quran, that war with the Christians will guarantee the salvation of their souls, the Muslims' inducements to desperate fighting are very powerful. You've been taught that if you can fight Christians, you get a guaranteed trip to heaven. Now, if you can get a guaranteed trip to heaven, that's worth taking. But how do you get it? By fighting Christians. So that's what they said. Their inducements to fight. It's really hard to reason with people. It's like trying to talk you out of your salvation. You're not willing to do that. Of course, we don't believe salvation is based on works. We believe it's based on faith in Jesus Christ. But when you believe that salvation is based on works, it's really hard to talk people out of doing the work that they believe leads them to salvation, which is war against Christians. So that was what we were facing. Now, when you go to where all the hatred is today, and you know, I mean, good gracious, here we are in a modern civilization. Why in the world would they want to fight Americans today? Real simple. Taught by revelation that war with the Christians will guarantee the salvation of their souls. The Muslims' inducements to desperate fighting are very powerful. Okay, yeah. But why attack the trade centers? Real simple. Taught by revelation that war with the Christians will guarantee the salvation of their souls. The Muslims induce them to desperate fighting are very powerful. Yeah, but why the Pentagon? Very simple. Taught by revelation that war with the... See, this is the thinking that we don't latch on to enough. And it's historical. It's what we faced for 32 years back at that point in time. You're going to fight well or you're going to pay well. And if you're not going to fight well, we're going to make you pay in other ways, sometimes with human lives, sometimes with the loss of lives, the over 5,000 casualties on 9/11. Now, going back to the Pentagon for a minute, this part of the Pentagon, when it was hit, this is my friend that was run over by the airplane of the Pentagon. When the Pentagon, and you see him here, Lieutenant Colonel Brian Birdwell, you may have seen him on TV a lot, but his office is right there. That's where his office was. When the plane hit the Pentagon, he was on the other side of the crash right there. He was standing right there when the plane went in. So when the plane hit, he was covered with jet fuel. He was set aflame. He was literally on fire right there before everything collapsed. So he is a human torch. As I watched the flames going up and I watched the smoke going in the sky, I had no idea that part of the smoke was him, was the flesh going off his skin. And where he was, and this is, again, another picture that Mike Garcia on the Pentagon Security Force took just about 7 minutes after the plane had hit. You can see the penetration point right there. There's nothing left there. It's gone in. And this is the point that would collapse a little bit later. And this is Brian's window right there on the left. And that's where, that 2 days later, they were to cover the remains of his coworkers. He had left the office there, and there were nothing but charred bodies when they were able to get the fire out. Brian was standing on the other side over that, where that window is. Now, because he was engulfed in the way that he was, he spent months in the hospital. This is a picture of him after weeks in the hospital. He's starting to look really good at this point in time. And actually, the next picture I'm going to show you is a little graphic, and it's when he looked really good. He's now been in the hospital 6 weeks and got some skin grafts going, so he's actually got some skin back on his arms at this point in time. The first 6 weeks, he had no skin. You could see the bones, all the muscle. I mean, he's gone through 39 surgeries. He's remarkable. He's actually giving his testimony here of what God did with him and what he went through. So he is a remarkable guy, but he's really good on military history as well. And one of the things he points out is that 9/11 wasn't a big start to the war on terror. If you look at what happened with terrorist attacks, you got to back up decades. I mean, everybody remember back to the Iranians taking the embassy? Now, let me make a point about embassies. When you have an embassy, that is, you're not in Iran. The American embassy in Iran was not Iranian property. The American embassy in Iran was American property just as much as we are right here. That's the international law. The Saudi embassy in Washington, D.C., that's not the Saudis sitting on American land. That's the Saudis sitting on Saudi land. You are an independent nation wherever your embassy is. That is international law. That's why if you can get into that embassy, then nobody in the nation where you are can touch you because you're not in that nation anymore. You're in the foreign. So the fact that happened in the American embassy means that America was attacked on its own property. That was the significance of what went on in Iran. It wasn't that we were in somebody else's nation and they attacked us. No. They attacked us on American property. And that was understood and known at the time. That was why it was such a big deal. But you see, that was just one of many things. Every 2 to 3 years, we had a major terrorist attack going against Americans across the world. 1983, the U.S. embassy bombing in Beirut. We lost 17 Americans and 100 wounded, and that's the U.S. Embassy. That's, again, attack on American property. It's Americans across the world, but they're on their own property. And the numbers I'm about to show you, I want you to understand they are all of American casualties. There were a lot of Lebanese that lost their life in these attacks, but I'm not talking about the nationals that lost their life. I'm talking about just the Americans. I want you to see how the Americans have been targeted for decades like this. In 1983, the Marine barracks in Beirut, 242 Americans killed, 81 wounded. Terrorist attack on Americans. We have 1984, the U.S. servicemen in Berlin. The terrorists said, hey, a lot of the servicemen go to this nightclub. Let's blow up the nightclub. They were hoping to kill a bunch of American military guys. They got 2 killed, 79 wounded. Got a lot of Germans killed in that attack. But another terrorist attack on Americans. Anywhere we can find Americans, we're going to find Americans. Here's the 1984 kidnapping and murder of Station Chief William Buckley in Lebanon. You have here the U.S. Embassy annex in Beirut. Not the embassy, but the embassy annex. Another piece of American property. 2 killed, 21 wounded. 1984, the Air Force Base in Torreon, Spain. 18 killed, 83 wounded. Anywhere we can find Americans, we're going to attack Americans. We have the TWA flight. This is a flight going to Greece. They got hijacked by terrorists. They said, oh, an American. He happens to be a Navy diver. We can kill him. And that's when the body was dumped out on the tarmac. You remember seeing that on national TV. That was 1985. We have 1988, the Pan Am flight over Lockerbie, Scotland. Terrorists blew that up, killed 189 Americans, not to mention all the others that were killed. That's just the Americans. The first World Trade Center bombing, 6 were killed, 1,000 were wounded in that. Terrorists came into New York City. The Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia, again, this is our property. 19 dead Americans, 372 wounded Americans. Then we have the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi, again, American property. They came onto American property, 12 dead, 6 wounded. We have the U.S. Embassy in Tanzania, didn't kill. It's amazing no one was killed in that because it was a terrific blast, but 7 wounded. We have the USS Cole in Yemen, 17 dead, 39 wounded. And by the way, the guys responsible for that, we decided we don't want to get money more, so we just released them. So the guys who did that are, you know, now out among us again. So the USS Cole in Yemen, we have the 9/11 attacks that produced the 5,000 casualties there. Do you realize that in those 20 years, we've lost 10,000 Americans? We've had 10,000 casualties. Now, we've been being attacked for 20 years before 9/11. 10,000 casualties. It's not a matter of whether you're going to lose lives. You are going to lose lives. The question is, what do you get when you lose lives? Because if you look back to this point in time with all the stuff, here's all these terrorist attacks, and I can show you a whole bunch more. All these terrorist attacks, 10,000 American casualties, we were completely on defense then. Let's talk about this. We can negotiate. We can reach an agreement. And at 9/11, we said, 20 years, we've had enough of this. We're going on offense. Now, once we went on offense, we still lost lives. We lost 4,060 lives so far on offense, but we've accomplished a lot of things in the meantime. We have seen some governments established. We have seen a number of cells completely destroyed. It's not that you're not going to lose American lives. We lost 10,000 over here. We've lost 4,000 since, but I will point out that we have not had a terrorist attack on Americans in 8 years, and that's the longest it's been in 30 years. You can't go any point in recent history over the last decades more than 3 or 4 years without a terrorist attack, and we've now gone 8 on this thing. You know, I talk to these military, I go to military bases. I don't like going overseas much at all, but I will go overseas for any American military base. And I go to military bases all the time to speak to those guys. I will travel for them anywhere. And so when I get there, I talk to the guys and they say, you know, we don't want to get killed. But that's our job. We're supposed to get killed so that you guys don't get killed. That's why we do this. They don't want to get killed. But 4,000 of them have been killed. But how many civilians have been killed in that point in time? It's nearly through the roof. It was 10,000 before. So it's a real turnaround, a real change that's happened. And Colonel Birdwell looks at this part of the nation, as we talked about the old Ottoman Empire, and he says, you know, it's really a lot like a swamp. When you live around a swamp, you're either going to have to get used to the mosquitoes that come out of the swamp, or you're going to have to decide that you want to go in and drain the swamp to get rid of the mosquitoes. One or the other. You either live with all the stuff that buzzes around you, or you go drain it to make a permanent solution. And that's really what that part of the world has been. It's been bugs coming out and going all over everywhere. I mean, that has been the breeding center for so much of what goes on around the world. And we said, we've had enough of this. What we decided to do, we decided to go in and drain the swamp. We're going to take care of the mosquitoes. We're going to make a permanent solution. That's what America did back in 1801 through 1816. We decided to go drain the swamp in that same region of the world. And that's exactly what we're doing now. And that's why it may be a 20-year process. It may take a while, but we'll finally reduce the numbers enough that they've decided, you know, it's not worth stirring these guys up again to have them come after us. We'll back off. We had about 100 years there where the Americans were not attacked after that period of time. I mean, that was the longest period we had. So when you hear all this stuff on the news and you see what goes on the news, you know, remember there is another side to the story. The media does not have a clue about a spiritual side or a historical side to this. This is something that unless you understand both the nature of Christianity and the nature of Islam, you will not understand the nature of the war on terror. I mean, you can't, because, again, motivated by a desire to go after Christians is a guarantee for salvation. That is a factor in what goes on. There's no way around that. Now, the other thing that I want to give the other side of real quickly here in the last part of what I do, I'm just going to go through this as quick as I can, and that is the president said, we're not a Christian nation. Then he went over to Egypt just a few weeks later, and he said, by the way, we are one of the largest Muslim nations in the world. And so we're not a Christian nation, but we are a Muslim nation. Now, I will point out that 78% of America claims to be Christian. Only 1% claims to be Muslim. So, by the way, I calculate math, I would say he's probably wrong. He's wrong according to math, but I can also tell you he's wrong according to history. Let me just quickly show you some quick quotes. Here's a quote from Democrat President Woodrow Wilson, who said this: America was born a Christian nation. America was born to exemplify that devotion to the elements of righteousness which are derived from the revelations of Holy Scripture. That's a Democrat president said that. Now here you've got a Republican president, so both parties saying the same thing. Richard Nixon, he says, let us remember that as a Christian nation, we have a charge and a destiny. Let's go back to Democrat president. Let's go back to President Harry Truman, who said this. He said, this is a Christian nation. He said, in this great country of ours has been demonstrated the fundamental unity of Christianity and democracy. He says, the fundamental basis of our Bill of Rights comes from the teachings which we get from Exodus and St. Matthew, from Isaiah and St. Paul. I don't think we emphasize that enough these days. I agree. We don't emphasize that enough these days. Now, point is, I can show you historically America's a Christian nation. We get it from the presidents. We see it from presidents, Congress. I can show you so many acts passed by Congress saying the same thing in the Supreme Court. I can give you hundreds of court cases saying America's a Christian nation. This is not a radical notion I've come up with in the last few minutes. This is something that's been there for 400 years. Now, what happens is, if we're not a Christian nation, or if we are a Christian nation, does that mean we're discriminatory against other religions? I mean, for example, is being a Christian nation, is that really kind of anti-Jewish? I mean, wouldn't we have to say that's anti? This is where I have so much fun. Because, you know, Christians have a tendency to say, yeah, probably is, you know, we're not a Christian nation because we really are pluralistic. We don't have a clue what we're talking about. Let me give you an example. Here's some Jewish leaders. Jeff Jacoby, Jewish columnist in the Boston Globe. Look what Jeff says. He says, this is a Christian country. It was founded by Christians and built on broad Christian principles. Threatening? Does that threaten me as a Jew? He says, far from it. It is precisely in this Christian country that Jews have known the most peaceful, prosperous, and successful existence in their long history. They got 5,000 years of history. He said, Christian America has been the best thing Jews have ever had. And then you can take someone like Aaron Zellman, Jewish author, heads of civil rights organization. He says, Christian America is the best home our people have found in 2,000 years. He says, this remains the most tolerant, most prosperous, and safest home we could be blessed with. And then you have folks like Dennis Prager, you know, Dennis, national talk show host. Dennis says, I believe that it's good that America is a Christian nation. I love his next comment. He says, too many Americans do not appreciate the connection between American greatness and American Christianity. Boy, is he exactly right. Rabbi Daniel Lappin, another talk show, great friend, rabbi. He's considered one of the 50 most influential rabbis in America. I had dinner with him last night. He and I are great friends. And this is what he said. He said, I understand that I live in a Christian nation. Without a vibrant and vital Christianity, America is doomed. And without America, the West is doomed. Now think about that. We lose the Christian nation, that influences the West, and guess what that means for Jews? And that's what he points out, which is why I, an Orthodox Jewish rabbi devoted to Jewish survival, the Torah and Israel, am so terrified of American Christianity caving in. He said, man, you Christians, you got to have some backbone just for the sake of all of us other religions that are in America. Now, I will tell you, the first experience I ever had with Rabbi Lappin, I didn't know him at the time, but a political party in the South passed part of their political platform. They had a plank that says America is a Christian nation and we need to preserve Christian values. Well, the media went through the roof. How intolerant, how bigoted, how terrible. And so Nightline got a hold of it. Nightline had this big thing and they said, is America really a Christian nation? How ridiculous. They brought two evangelical Christian ministers on. They brought a Jewish Orthodox rabbi and they said, you know, this plank in the political platform says America is a Christian nation. What do you say about that? And both Christian ministers said, oh no, that's no way. That is intolerant. And the Jewish rabbi was laughing. He said, you guys are crazy. Of course it's a Christian nation. If it doesn't stay a Christian, I thought, I love it. The Orthodox Jew is defending Christianity, and the Christians are running from it. You know, and so. But like he said, that's why I'm terrified of American Christianity caving in. He said, God help Jews if America ever becomes a post-Christian society. Just think of Europe. See? Why are we scared to be, yes, it's a Christian nation. Oh, and we get called all sorts of names. Exactly right. We do. But we got to stand up for what's right and for what's truth and for what's factual. And Rabbi Lappin was telling me last night that he undertook an investigation that lasted several months. And what he did was he took 1,000 years of inventions. He went back and says, let's look at all the great inventions over the last 1,000 years in science and technology and medicine, whatever. What is it that's elevated mankind in the last 1,000 years? And he identified all these inventions. You know what he found? Jewish rabbi found that 98.5% of those inventions were invented by Christians. Out of all the inventions that shifted and changed the world in the last 1,000 years, kind of good to be a Christian nation, isn't it? See, that's what we understood. We used to understand that, could it be that Christianity is a blessing for all people, even non-Christians? And could it be that being a Christian nation is a blessing for all people, even non-Christians? Absolutely. You see, what we knew was that a Christian nation provided eight secular benefits. I'm not going to have time to run through all of them. I'm going to try to take off as fast as I can. Let me define first what a Christian nation is. This is done by Supreme Court Justice David Brewer. David Brewer was on the court for a number of decades back in the late 1800s, and he's one of the justices that gave a unanimous decision of the U.S. Supreme Court that says America is a Christian nation. All justices agreed. There wasn't any kind of a partisan split. They'd been appointed by both parties, and they said, of course we're a Christian nation. Unanimous decision by the Supreme Court. This is what Justice Brewer said. He says, we constantly speak of this republic as a Christian nation. In fact, as a leading Christian nation of the world. He said, in what sense can it be called a Christian nation? He said, well, not in the sense that Christianity is the established religion or that the people are in any manner compelled to support it. We don't force people to support Christianity here, or we don't establish it by law. He says, neither is it Christian in the sense that all of his citizens are either in fact or name Christians. And that's sure true. And he said, on the contrary, all religions have free scope within our borders. Numbers of our people profess other religions, and many reject all religions. He says, nor is it Christian in the sense that a profession of Christianity is a condition of holding office, nor is it essential to recognition either politically or socially. If you're not a Christian, that doesn't mean you have a lower social status or a higher social status or a lower economic. It has nothing to do with any of it. He says, nevertheless, we constantly speak of this republic as a Christian nation. In fact, as the leading Christian nation of the world. So if it's not all that, how can you call it a Christian nation? He says, America is most justly called a Christian nation because Christianity has so largely shaped and molded it. That's what makes a Christian nation. Not that everybody's Christians, not by a long shot. You see, Christianity in America shaped and molded, and that's what President Teddy Roosevelt said. Teddy Roosevelt said, the teachings of the Bible are so interwoven and intertwined with our civic and social life that it would be impossible for us to figure out what life would be if these teachings were removed. You see, if secular people could just stop and say, no, wait a minute, is that an American teaching or is that a Christian teaching that got incorporated into America? You would find secular people be some of the greatest pro-Christian people if they knew that. But what's happened is they think that because it's American, it has nothing to do with Christianity. And that's a result of our education over the last 30 years. But you see, it is our civic and social life that's built on Christianity. Christianity in America has produced very clearly eight things. And I'm going to run through them quickly. A Republican form of government. Do you remember that when the settlers were coming to America, what form of government did you have all over Europe where they came from? Monarchies. Were they electing people anywhere in Europe then? No. But what happened is you get the pilgrims and you have people like Pastor John Robinson. I mean, when he had those folks getting on the boat right there, he gave them a sermon. He said, now, when you get to America, he said, you're not going to do what we did over here. He said, you're going to have annual elections. And you're going to elect the common people. You're not going to elect lords and nobles. You're going to elect from among you common people. Radical notion. They hadn't even got off the Mayflower Compact before they write it down on a piece of paper called the Mayflower. They hadn't got off the Mayflower boat before they wrote it down in the Mayflower Compact. They started having annual elections. Wasn't going on. You see, and you find others like in Virginia, Reverend Richard Burke is the one who helped set up the first elected body in America in Virginia. He prayed over them, and they met inside the church. The legislature met inside the church. They had elections, and that's where folks met. They weren't trying to create a theocracy. They want to make sure that have elections represented people. You have the same thing with Reverend Roger Williams, who founded Rhode Island. He's a preacher. He didn't set up a theocracy. He set up an elected form of government. He said, we're having annual elections every single year. You have Thomas Hooker. He's a preacher who set up Connecticut. He didn't set up a theocracy. He set up elected form of government. Not only did they have elections every year, he wrote it down in a constitution, America's first written constitution. He said, we're going to put it in paper so that your leaders can't come back and gyp you out of your rights. We're going to have it written down so that you can have elections and you can control your leaders. See, we're told that if Christians get a hold of America today, they're going to create a theocracy. No, every time Christians got a hold of government, we've created a Republican form of government, let people have the power and let people choose and have elections. That's what's been a product of Christianity all the way through. Reverend William Penn in 1676 established the government of Jersey, made sure we had elections. 1781, he did Pennsylvania, made sure every preacher went in that he had elections. That was not happening in Europe. That came out of the Bible. It comes out of Deuteronomy 1, 15 and 16. It comes out of Exodus 18, 21. It comes out of Acts 7. I could give you all the verses, but I'll tell you, a Republican form of government came out of the Bible. If we lose a Christian nation, we lose our Republican form of government. The second thing we lose is the rights of conscience. You see, so many people came to America being persecuted for what they believed. They got here, and we had people from all denominations, all backgrounds that came here, and suddenly you could practice your faith here and not get killed for it. Now, of course, the textbooks say, oh, yeah, how about those intolerant Puritans who had the witch trials? I'm glad you said that. Let me tell you something about the witch trials. The witch trials lasted for 3 months in Massachusetts, 1681, 1682. Do you know how many Americans were put to death in the witch trials? 21. That's 21 too many. Let me point out something. We talk about the witch trials in our textbook. We never talk about how they ended. Do you know how they ended? They ended when three Christian ministers, Reverend John Wise, Reverend Increase Mather, and Thomas Brattle, went to Governor Phipps and said, Phipps, these trials you're doing, they're civil trials, these trials you're doing, you're not following the biblical rules of evidence in the trials, and you're convicting people on basis that violates biblical evidence. You need to stop this. Phipps looked at the Bible and said, you are right. He went to Judge Sewell, and he said, Judge Sewell, he said, we got to stop the trials because we're not doing it the way the Bible says to do trials. Judge Sewell stopped the trials. Judge Sewell then stood up in church the next Sunday and repented in front of the whole congregation for not having followed the biblical rules of evidence in the trials. The governor then called a colony-wide day of prayer and fasting, seeking to avert God's judgment for not having... It's an interesting thing. The Bible is what stopped the witch trials in America, not what started them. Now, while I'm talking about it, do you know what happened to the witch trials in Europe at the same point in time? 500,000 people put to death in the witch trials in Europe. 21 put to death in America, and it wasn't the Christians who were doing it. It was the civil government who was doing it. It was the Christians who stopped it. See, rights of conscience, they come from Christianity. They come only from Christianity. You won't find that in a secular nation, a Hindu nation, a Muslim nation, any other nation. The right to believe what we want to believe is a Christian characteristic. Same thing with the free market approach to religion. We're not scared of other religions. In 1619, we had Muslims in America. 1654, we had Jewish synagogues in America. 1800, we had Buddhist temples in America. We weren't scared of other religions. Why is that? Because nobody in the Bible was scared of religions. God always gave people choice. He gave Adam and Eve a choice. It's real simple. Remember Joshua, when Joshua had all the people together? I love the little speech he gave to them there. Here's the old man, Joshua 24. He says, all right, he says, If serving the Lord doesn't seem like a good idea to you, he said, you don't have to, but you've got some choices to make. You can decide whether you want to serve the gods of your forefathers on the other side of the river where we used to be, or you can decide if you want to serve the gods of the Amorites, and that's the land where we are right now. He said, you make your choices. Now, me and my family, we're going to serve the Lord. We got choices out here. Choices don't scare us. You got the right to make a choice. We're choosing the Lord. I love the way Elijah went after it. You know, Elijah was outnumbered, 400 false prophets, 450 prophets of Baal in 1 Kings 18. And he told the other religion, you guys take all the time you want. Just keep praying, keep doing it. Your religion doesn't scare me. You just make sure I get my shot at it. See, we're not scared of other religions. We just want to make sure that we get an equal playing field. And that's what he told the people. He said, how long will you waver between two opinions? If God's God, follow him. If Baal's Baal, follow him. Make your choice. You got a choice. We don't coerce you into believing anything. And see, that's what makes America so remarkable. That's why Jews can come to America and know it's a Christian nation and be safe here, because we don't force them on what to believe. We believe that we put out the truth. Holy Spirit's going to do what he will with it, and that's fine. But we believe the truth wins. I love the way Ezra Stiles said this. Ezra Stiles is the president of Yale University. He was a soldier in the American Revolution, great theologian. He said it this way. He said, religious liberty is peculiarly friendly to fair and generous inquiry. Real religion, we're not scared of people questioning it. He said the Bible will be found to stand the test to the 10,000th examination. You come after the Bible as often as you want to, and it'll stand up to any test you want to give it. He says, here, deism will have its full chance. Deism can complain of being overcome by no weapons other than the gentle, the powerful ones of argument and truth. Real simple. We'll win because we believe we got the truth, but we're not scared of other religions. See, that's why you have the free market approach to religion. That's why we have over 26 different kinds of religions in America. That's a Christian nation. Try finding that in a secular nation or in an Islamic nation or a Buddhist nation or a Hindu nation or anywhere else. Christianity gives you those choices. Christianity also gives you institutional separation, church and state. Back at the beginning, God says, all right, Moses, you're over the civil stuff. Aaron, you're over the priestly stuff. And you're two different people and you got two different functions. And in 1 Chronicles 26, when King Uzziah tried to change that, King Uzziah, God had blessed him like crazy, and he's the leader of the state, and he goes into the temple and says, I'm going to offer some sacrifices. I'm doing so good with God, I'll be a priest too. And the priest said, don't do it. Bad deal. And he did it anyway, and God struck him down on the spot. God made it real clear, nope, you keep government and church separate. Two different things, and we understood that. Now, what happened was, in the first three centuries, we practiced that, but the next 12 centuries, we forgot that. The next 12 centuries, the state took over the church. The state said, you know, we're going to tell you what to do. We're going to determine theology, and we want you guys to do the civil punishment. So we'll tell you what the doctrines are supposed to be, and if people get them wrong, you punish them for getting them wrong. So the church took over the state, and what happened, that's where we get all those atrocities that we talked about before. That's what made the Dark Ages, is all that stuff that went on. God then, over a period of 250 years, raised up about 25 ministers who said, no, it's time to get back to the Bible, do things right. They were called dissenters. They dissented against both church and state, and there were a number of them, a number of famous leaders. But what really set it off was King Henry VIII. Henry VIII wanted a divorce. That wasn't biblical. The church wouldn't let him have a divorce. He said, fine, I'll just start my own church. I'm going to give myself a divorce. I'm going to be head of the church, and this is real simple. When he did that, it's interesting to see what he did with the parliament in England. These are some actual historical documents. You see there, an ordinance of the lords and commons assembled in parliament. What does the law deal with? Who can take the Lord's Supper? You mean you got parliament saying who can, who can't take the Lord's Supper? Yeah, how about this one? Declaration of the commons assembled in parliament. They're saying who can and who can't preach the gospel. You got the government saying who can take communion, who can and can't preach the gospel. That's when Reverend Richard Hooker said, this is it. He said, we got to have separation church and state. That's the first modern uses of the phrase separation church and state by a preacher in the 1580s saying, Henry, you're crazy. Church is over here separate from you. You're civil. Church is over here. And that's the way we had it. And so those people who came to America brought with them an institutional separation church and state. They did not let the government take over the church. Simple. Now, we've seen it change today. The government tells us what we can and can't say out of the pulpit. And government tells us what words we can and can't use in prayers in public. It tells us what we can and can't say at graduation. Now, government's telling us what we can do. Government's taking over religion again. But see, from Christians, you get the institutional separation, church and state. You also have the fifth characteristic, common school education. There wasn't education in America until Christians got after it. First university started in America is Harvard, started by the Reverend John Harvard. Reverend John Harvard. Same thing with William and Mary, started by the Reverend John Blair. Same thing with Princeton by the Reverend Jonathan Dickinson. You know, by 1860, we had 246 colleges in America, and guess what? Only 5% of them were not affiliated with the denomination. Every college in America was a result of Christians doing something with it. Even the 17 that weren't denominationally affiliated had required chapel and Bible reading at the state universities, every single one of them. And by the way, in 1860, 91% of all college presidents were ministers of the gospel. Christians are what produced common education. By 1884, you'll find that in 1884, we had 370 colleges in America, and 83% were denominational. Without the church, without Christians, you don't have education in America. Real simple stuff. So you look not only at education, but you look also at the free market system. Free market system, two governors did that in America. They came out of Europe where we didn't have free market, and these guys each quoted two verses, 1 Timothy 5:8 and 2 Thessalonians 3:10. They came up with the free market system. They had a communal system, what we would technically call a socialistic system, and they said that's not biblical. The Bible says each person is to provide for their own household. We're all providing for everybody else's household. That's not biblical. And so they set this thing up. Now, it's interesting. There were three biblical teachings that did it. And three teachings. One is Matthew 20, where Jesus says, your labor is yours. You can sell your labor to the highest bidder. Labor doesn't belong to the state. Jesus established a great principle between employers and employees that if you have labor and skill, you can sell it to the highest bidder. As an employee, you have the right to do that. That's free market. You can go find the best employer you want. That's your choice. You get the choice of where you want to take your skills. Same thing. Jesus teaches us that skill is rewarded. The parable of the talents, everybody got a talent, but this guy turned it into 5, this guy turned it into 10, and they got rewarded. You didn't do anything with what you're given, you don't get rewarded. We reward skill. We give more to skill. And then finally, we even rewarded profit. Luke 19, the one who had the one did nothing. The one who had the 5, 1 turned it into 5. The one who had the 1 turned it into 10. Jesus said, take the guy who did nothing and give it to the guy who had 10. And they said, whoa, that's not fair. He's already got 10. Jesus says, to him who has will more be given. Whom has not will be taken away that which he has. Jesus said, you made a bunch of profit. I'm going to reward you. In America, we say, ooh, you made profit. We got to penalize you. You didn't make any profit. We're going to, we got it backwards. You made no profit. Let's reward you. Jesus said, no, you made no profit. We're taking away from you, giving to the guy who can make profit. See, all of those things go into free market, and that comes out of the Bible. And that's what we understood. And that's why Thomas Jefferson said, the pillars of our prosperity are the most thriving when left most free to individual enterprise. That's a biblical principle of free market. Same thing Ben Franklin said, a free market is the means under God of establishing the freedom of our country entire and handing it down complete to prosperity. Free markets come from God. That is a biblical teaching. It came out of the Bible. Last two, benevolence. There is no nation, Pastor said it earlier. Jack was talking about how we're the most generous people in the world. We are. Anywhere a crisis happens in the world, America is the first one running in on the scene. Even our enemies, if something tragic happens, we immediately go there. I mean, that's just part of who we are. Where did we learn that benevolence? Came out of Christianity. John Adams said it this way. He said, Christian, see that? Christian benevolence makes it our indispensable duty to lay ourselves out to serve our fellow creatures to the utmost of our power. Christianity says, go sacrifice yourself for others. See, the Saint Richard Allen, he founded the AME Church, great civil rights leader in the founding era, great preacher. He was a soldier in the American Revolution. Richard Allen said, Christian charity is pure and disinterested. It's remote from all hopes of worldly recompense. We help others without expecting to get help back. He says, we are to do good and lend, hoping for nothing again. That's what Jesus tells us. It's confined to no persons, countries, or places. We don't just help those around us. We help those in other places. He says strangers as well as relations or acquaintances, enemies as well as friends. It has no measure other than the love of God to us. As much love as God showed us, we want to show that to everybody else. The absolute necessity of practicing benevolence is the very same as being a Christian. You can't be a Christian and not be benevolent. That was the way we understood it. You see, and that's why in America, we have all these radical ideas of benevolence. You look at all the nations in the world. You got a lot of different nations in the world, Muslim, Buddhist, and secular, and Hindu, and Christian. But when we have national, international disasters like the tsunami in Indonesia, guess what? It wasn't the other nations that came running to help. It was America. And more than that, it was Christian America who came running to help. That's benevolence. That's why, to this day, we still teach the Good Samaritan, even in civil law. That only Christianity teaches the Good Samaritan, but we think that's good for society. That's why all 50 states have Good Samaritan laws on the books. By the way, we also think that it's a really good deal to teach things like the Golden Rule. That teaching comes out of Christianity. Can you imagine what society would be like if we took away the Good Samaritan and the Golden Rule? Even secular people believe in that. You take Christianity out of the nation, you lose those two teachings. You've got a whole different kind of people. So only from Christianity you get that teaching. Final thing, is that of inalienable rights. We have that in the Declaration. Declaration is real clear. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. They're endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Here's the newsflash. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. Governments exist to protect inalienable rights. That's the American philosophy of government. Now, where did we get this radical notion that in American government that there is a creator, that the creator gives certain inalienable rights to man, and the government exists to protect those rights? Where did we get that radical notion? Well, when you look at the Declaration, great historians like Clinton Roster, who wrote an award-winning book, Seed Time of the Republic, he said, where did these radical ideas come from? And he went back and identified the six greatest intellectual sources in shaping American government. Four of the six were preachers of the gospel. You have preachers that shape, the way we think. So much of what we have in government came from them. And John Wise is a great example, because John Wise is the guy who came up with the concept of inalienable rights out of the Bible. He printed sermons in 1710 and 1717 that were reprinted in 1772 and 1774 and distributed by among all the patriots. They then took his book and writing the Declaration, and they quoted directly out of it. As President Calvin Coolidge said on the 150th anniversary of the Declaration, he said, the thoughts in the Declaration can be very largely traced back to what Reverend John Wise was writing. Here was the doctrine of equality, a popular sovereignty, and inalienable rights asserted by Wise. See, even the doctrine of inalienable rights is something that comes from Christianity. So the president says we're not a Christian nation. Now, if that is true, are you prepared to give up all these rights here? Because they're all the product of Christianity. If we're not a Christian nation, you've got to take all those rights out. You find me a secular nation that has those rights. You find me a nation of any other religion that has those rights. If we like those rights, we better like staying a Christian nation. So in closing down tonight, this is the time that we remember what happened 8 years ago. But what happened 8 years ago is not separate from our faith. As a matter of fact, Christianity is the base of a lot of what happened eight years ago. And when we look at what happened 8 years ago and it launched the war on terror, man, the scripture tells us very clearly, you give honor to whom honor is due. There's been a lot of people who've been willing to step up now and say, okay, so you guys won't get whacked. We'll take the bullets. And they've been doing that. And the scripture says, no greater love hath any man than he lays down his life for his friend. And that's what so many people, first responders and our soldiers, have been willing to do, is lay down their lives for the rest of us. And there's nothing greater than that. You see, and it's cost a whole lot of them. I was recently at the Arlington Cemetery, and they have that special area in Arlington Cemetery of those who were killed on 9/11, the soldiers who were in the Pentagon, the civilians in the Pentagon that day, the responders that were also killed as a result. But I am struck with the fact that over our history, 43 million Americans have been willing to be killed if they needed to for the rest of us. That's a bunch of people. You know, to lay down your life for your friend is one thing, but they're willing to lay down their lives for people they never met. And that's a whole lot of love, to be willing to lay down their lives for people that they'd never met. Out of those, we've still got, to this day, 18 million military veterans still alive today. That's a lot of people who are willing to do something for the rest of us. And by the way, 1.2 million of our soldiers have never come home from being willing to give their life. It's a lot of blood that's been shed, but that's so that we could do what we're doing this very night. No question about it. So we want to remember their sacrifice. We want to preserve their sacrifice, not let it be wasted. As Jack said earlier, we got to finish this war. Otherwise, it is a waste of life. If we do not finish this war, the 4,000 we've lost, the 10,000 before that, we'll keep having those mosquitoes coming out of that swamp, coming after Americans. We'll have the same thing. So something that does have to be finished, we need to preserve that. And let's remember, too, that we are a Christian nation. God bless you guys. Thanks for letting me share with you.